Hey everybody, Mike Lawson here with CU Broadcast. On the show today, we have NCUA's Vice Chairman Rick Metzger talking about the member business lending and field of membership changes. So check them out. Hey, we're talking about some member business lending changes that you guys have been talking about as of late. I mean, tell me about these changes. I mean, what spurred this action now? Because it's from what I read, these things, they haven't been changed since 2003, I think was the last time somebody addressed this. So what's going on here?
Well, first of all, yeah, with the history, you know, kind of remind everyone that there was no MBL cap at all
for credit unions
until 1998.
Gotcha.
That was one of the gifts that credit unions got for their Membership Credit Union Act, is that they had a cap put on them for MBLs. And so the rulemaking for that didn't get complete until, I think, about 2002.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
You know, it's kind of a recent, you know, phenomenon in terms of writing rules to adjust the congressional action. Mm-hmm. But since then, especially since the Great Recession, and we have the data since that time, it's become very clear to us that system-wide, credit unions are managing their MBL portfolio well, mm-hmm. and certainly comparable to banks. And in fact, they have done actually exceptionally well. Their delinquencies are down, charge-offs are down. And if you look at credit unions with an MBL program as a group, mm-hmm. They actually score better on many key metrics than credit unions who don't have MBL portfolios.
Okay. And so this is kind of like almost kind of like a shot in the arm for credit unions, like, hey, now we're making these changes. Why not dive into this endeavor? Because it can be very profitable for us.
Well, you know, we hear a lot from credit unions who are interested in going into, you know, commercial lending, member business lending. Not all do. I mean, it's not something that you do lightly. It's a totally different than consumer lending. You have to have the staff to do that. You have mm-hmm. to have the expertise. Mm-hmm. You have to have the risk appetite for that. And that's the important part of it. So it's not, you know, I don't think we want to make it look as if a credit union has to go into member business lending to be profitable. Yeah. That certainly is not the case at all.
Right.
But for those that have that appetite and have that skill level, mm-hmm. it certainly allows them to balance their portfolios more, mm-hmm. To spread the risk around. And when you look at the results of credit unions with those portfolios compared to the rest of their balance sheet, they actually do quite well.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like their value offering goes through the roof, or not through the roof, but I mean, it just goes up if
sure.
you offer this as well. So,
well, yeah, in fact, credit unions with an MBL program, for example, have an average ROA of 0.86 compared to the average credit union that does not have an MBL program of just 0.46.
Okay.
98% of credit unions who have member business lending are well capitalized,
mm-hmm.
and that represents 99% of all MBLs outstanding. So those that have the appetite have clearly also brought the expertise in-house in order to make that a viable part of serving their members' needs.
Okay, great. And now, I mean, what are a couple of the significant changes that we're talking about here? I think one was a 17.5% cap for credit unions over 100 million in assets. I mean, is that one of them? And then I'm sure there's a whole myriad of more. Are there a couple more significant ones that really stand out?
Well, the most significant change, Mike, is that heretofore, if they're going to make any changes or want any changes to the current rule, they have to come to NCUA to ask for a waiver on a particular loan.
Okay.
That's probably the biggest and most important change in the MBL rule. Doing so is by having this prescriptive rule that where they go through a checklist of whether you can give a loan or not, and coming to NCUA for a you know, permission to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In this world of financial services, where people want and expect an answer right now, or
yeah.
they go somewhere else, we have heard from many, many credit unions where good projects, good loans were walking out the door because it was too labor intensive to wait for an answer.
Gotcha.
So by going from a prescriptive policy mm-hmm. To a principles-based policy, mm-hmm. where it allows you to make those decisions within the framework of making reasonable decisions,
mm-hmm.
looking not so much at collateral, but analyzing the business at hand, their mm-hmm. cash flow, and their ability to be successful,
yep.
allows that decision to be made at the credit union level, and they can compete with other financial providers to provide that loan.
Thanks. Oh my gosh, that's such a huge difference for them, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Goodness. What are some of the goals for these? I mean, what's the overall picture? Obviously, we talked about, it can make your credit more profitable and your value goes up and that type of stuff. What else? I mean, what are the big goals here for these changes?
Well, I think a couple of things. Number one is it gives credit unions a lot more flexibility in terms of marketing to their members who are small business owners. Mm-hmm. And they can do that more aggressively if they choose to do so, knowing that they can react positively to their members. Mm-hmm. I think with the prior prescriptive rules, you know, that kind of restrains a credit union in terms of how aggressive you're going to be if you know that you can't be able to deliver the expectations of your members. Yep. So I think that's the first part of it. I think the second part of it is it allows credit unions to look more broadly at their whole balance sheet in order to spread the risk in terms of consumer lending, home mortgages, mm-hmm. member business lending. Mm-hmm. There are some advantages to a credit union to be more diversified.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
This allows them to be more diversified, mm-hmm. Thus, you know, minimizing risk, assuming, you know, again, underwriting, which is a key issue, they have strong underwriting. It's actually a strong advantage for them.
Heck yeah, definitely. Let's switch gears here for a second here. Talking about more changes, this time there's some big news coming down from you guys this week about the NCUA now automatically qualifying 12 groups as valid associations as they relate to field of membership. Now, this is something you've been championing since you've joined the NCUA, and kudos to you for really taking the reins on this. And so what does this qualification mean for credit unions? Now, what does this automatic qualification mean for credit unions?
Well, it goes back to that whole waiver issue where up to this point, even groups that we know would qualify, they would have to be submitted to the NCUA. We would have to give their blessing and give mm-hmm. that back. Mm-hmm. So number one, it creates paperwork for the credit union. Number two, it creates paperwork for NCUA. And then when we actually looked at the history of this, overwhelmingly, those types of associations were always approved. So it's almost you know, a waste of time on everybody's part mm-hmm. to do something in which you know the outcome to invest time in. So what we did is we looked at what are the types of groups that we believe statutorily fit the responsible organization to be able to join that particular credit union. Mm-hmm. Looked at the history of all those and which ones fell into those groups that are most commonly mm-hmm. brought to us for our approval, that we always approve. And we were able to identify 12 larger groups, you know, like, for example, obviously an individual business, but say an alumni association, et cetera, that we always approve.
Yep.
And be able to tell a credit union, if you have one of those 12, mm-hmm. then that's going to be an automatic inclusion.
Then just go for it, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, you notify us that they're added to your membership, but you don't have to go through this approval process. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So again, that solves not only a time problem, it also solves a paperwork problem for them and for us that is totally unnecessary. What it also means is if you have another organization that you're not so sure it fits your membership, mm-hmm. you think it does, mm-hmm. so you want to apply to us. Now we have a lot smaller plate of applications.
Oh, great point.
To look at, and we can expedite that approval process a lot faster than rather a whole stack. And when we get to you, we'll talk to you. But now there's going to be much fewer or many fewer applications, and we should be able to turn those out much faster.
Yeah, you're kind of unclogging the system, so to speak.
Exactly.
Okay, my next question here, my wrap-up question, which comes from left field. As I was researching this whole thing, I came across an op-ed piece in CU Times by Cliff Rosenthal, who was talking about most cooperatives throughout the world just have kind of a broad membership, an all-inclusive. And he was questioning, and there's like, well, why can't credit unions just do this? Wipe out all these, you know, business segs and all this type of stuff and just have a big membership thing and kind of like a Costco or something. I know that's kind of a general term, but why can't we do that? I mean, I know I'm probably displaying my ignorance here, but why can't we just have a one big membership type of thing here?
Well, a few blocks away from here is a thing called the Capitol. It's a statutory requirement. Field of membership and those restrictions are written in federal statute. So it would require a change in federal law, first of all. So that's the the practical answer.
That's the big one.
And you know that how difficult it is to move something, you know, through Congress, particularly something that there are other financial institutions out there who have spent years and years trying to constrain the ability of credit unions to compete.
Yeah.
So that's the practical answer. Now, from a public policy standpoint, I think you have to remember that credit unions, and we always hear this from certainly the banking entities, that you know, their tax exempt status. What's important for everyone to always remember is the tax exempt status does not come because of their membership. The tax exempt status comes as a result of the fact that they're organized as not-for-profit cooperatives. So if you look at it from a public policy standpoint, it is in the consumer's best interest to be able to choose what type of financial institution they would like to have a relationship. And so I would concur certainly with the author of the article that from a consumer standpoint, just like with any other financial institution, you're not limited to go to Wells Fargo. You're not limited if you want to go to SunTrust, that you should be able to go to a not-for-profit financial institution if that's what you choose to do. But the statute does limit that. So what we are left to do, but what I think is incumbent on us and why we're doing this with field of membership changes in MBLs, is looking at the authorities that we have along the edges of the statute to provide the American consumer as much freedom as possible to be able to choose their credit union institution to meet their needs.
Gotcha.
But to actually open it wide up, while it's good public policy, the fact of the matter is it's not current public policy.
Yeah, I mean, I just remember joining a credit union for the first time way back, and I'm like, why is it so segmented? You know, why can't we just, like, again, I know I'm overgeneralizing, why can't it be just like a Costco or something like that, where you just pay your annual membership fee and you're in and you get these great services and stuff? So yes, you explained it very well.
Yeah, yeah, that's what it is.
Gotcha, gotcha. Well,
you could take care of that, Mike.
What's that?
I mean, no one else has been able to change that. So, you know, it gets, you know, lost into Congress, you know?
We'll get right on that. I got nothing else to do. We'll get on it, Rick. Well, thank you so much, Rick. I appreciate your time as always, and your input is always invited and appreciated. So I appreciate the time as always, sir. Thank you.
You too, Mike. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.